From WBUR and NPR, I'm Callum Borchers.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now. President Biden will sign three more executive orders today, continuing his effort to overturn the previous administration's strict immigration policies. One of the orders will create a task force to help reunite about 600 migrant children who are still separated from their parents. At least 5,500 kids were split from their families under the Trump administration, and for the past 2 years, a court-appointed team has been actively working to get them back together. Kathleen Caron is Executive Director of Justice in Motion, a group that is part of that team. Kathleen, welcome.
Thank you.
And what do you make of Biden's executive orders to create a task force that would reunite more children with their families? Is that enough?
The task force is the very first step. Biden needs to take quick, bold action to do the right things to these families that were horrifically affected by the terrible family separation policy.
Well, help us quantify this problem, because in the final weeks of the Trump administration last October, we learned that nearly 600 children were still separated from their families. Has there been any progress since then reuniting those kids? I mean, how big is the problem still?
Well, the first step is finding the parents. We're part of the ACLU lawsuit that was charged with finding the parents as step one. Through the lawsuit, there was very few families who could return. Over 1,000 were forcibly removed from the United States after they were separated from their children. So the ones that are in Central America need to come back to the United States. That is something only President Biden can do, because the lawsuit can't bring all of those 1,000 families back to be safely reunited in the United States.
I see. So describe that work of finding those families who are now back in Guatemala, Honduras, El Salvador. How hard is that job to find those families?
It's difficult because the Trump administration had no plan or intention to reunite these families. So they did not set up a database and track the families. The ones that were deported, they said were categorically ineligible to reunify with their children. So the task was really difficult in mountainous communities, rural areas, searching for these parents based on very bad data from the U.S. government that were giving to us in drips and drabs. It was almost like slow torture over the past 2.5 years to get enough information to have more solid leads to look for these families.
Can you describe what it's like when you do find one of these families and they realize that perhaps they're at least a step closer to finding their children?
The parents are understandably deeply distrustful because of what they suffered. So we have a defender network. Justice in Motion Defender Network has over 40 organizations that we collaborate with in Mexico and Central America. And these are the on-the-ground experts, human rights lawyers in the field who are part of these communities. So how you search for them and how you approach someone that's been so deeply harmed by the government is something that takes a lot of skill, and we're relying on local partners to do this work. And so getting over the distrust to say, we can actually help you. So it takes quite a bit to bring up the belief. And sometimes we can't find a parent because they don't want to be found. Many, many were escaping for their lives and seeking safety with their families in the United States. So upon return, they're hiding.
How are the kids doing here in the U.S.?
The children are either with sponsors, which could be an extended family, or they're in foster care in the United States. So they are still suffering. Many of them are still separated from their parents. This is ongoing harm for these families. They need access to mental health services to try to deal with the separation, but they can't even start that process. It's much harder to start that process if they don't have legal status in the United States.
There are some concerns that the president's orders and the plans to reverse the Trump administration's policies in immigration would create a sense that there's new opportunity to come to the United States and create a new wave of immigrants here coming to the U.S. What do you think about that? Is that a valid concern?
I think the valid concern is that the U.S. needs to step up and show that we're a civilized country and that that family separation policy was abhorrent. And if President Biden doesn't do something for those families, he is sending the message that, you know what, it's all right that that happened to those families. I think what we need to focus is on the harm of, you know, over 5,000 families that were deeply, deeply injured by one of the most egregious immigration policies in the history of this country. That's what he needs to focus on. There's other ways to think bigger term about building the rule of law in the countries of origins to ensure that there's peace so people feel like they don't have to migrate.
That's Kathleen Caron, founder and executive director of Justice in Motion, a group that is trying to reunite parents with children who have been separated at the U.S. and Mexico border. Kathleen, thank you so much.
Thank you, Peter, for the opportunity.
Now, from immigration to impeachment, House impeachment managers have filed a brief ahead of next week's Senate trial, arguing that former President Donald Trump is singularly responsible for the deadly riot at the U.S. Capitol last month. Lawmakers are calling for Trump to be convicted of incitement of insurrection and barred from holding future federal office. Let's bring in NPR senior political editor and correspondent Domenico Montanaro. Domenico, this 80-page pretrial brief from House managers says the Capitol riot wouldn't have happened, quote, without President Trump creating a powder keg, striking a match, and then seeking personal advantage from the ensuing havoc. So what do Democrats say in the brief to back that up?
Well, they point to his statements from that day and his false claims that there was widespread election fraud. That's what they point to, that created the environment for which the Capitol was ransacked. And obviously, many of the people who went to the Capitol were waving Trump flags. They were saying that the president sent them, that they were trying to overturn the results because they felt that it was, falsely conducted. And they were many chanting "Stop the Steal," and had this hashtag that was tweeted around and shared millions of times, and was all stemming from President Trump's false claims that he actually won the election.
So there's a lot of substance to debate here. There's also a process debate, right? Because there's some debate about whether this trial can even go on after President Trump has left office. And in response, House managers have said there is no January exception that allows a president to incite an insurrection. So how are they making that case that they can indeed try and convict a president who's already left office?
Well, we also just got a reply from the president's lawyers, 14-page answer, quote unquote. It's not exactly what the a brief that was filed that's also due on February 8th. It's not that, but it's an answer to some of these questions. And you know, they deny that that the president tried to incite anyone. They also make a constitutional argument first and foremost. They say that. They focus on this on the word and that's because of the phrase that's in the Constitution about there are two penalties: one, resignation, taking someone out of office, and followed by barring them from public office. They're focusing on that word and to make this constitutional argument. Democrats, however, are pointing to a 145-year-old precedent, which the Senate voted on whether it was constitutional to take up the impeachment trial of President Grant's war secretary, William Belknap, who had, been essentially on the take, taking about $20,000 a quarter back then, which added up to about $2 million a year. But there was this constitutional argument about whether or not that was okay. The Senate agreed to go forward with it, but only by, a majority of 37 to 29. And they wound up acquitting Belknap because some 40% of the members of the Senate who disagreed that it was constitutional to take it up said so. The impeachment managers back then actually said that they thought that by doing this, that they would no longer ever have to, have this argument. They said it has been settled thereby that persons who have held civil office in the United States are impeachable and that the Senate has jurisdiction to try them. Well, here we are 145 years later with the exact same arguments being made.
Yeah, they might be surprised to find out it's not so settled after all, and there's some history for both sides to seize on there. Domenico, I'm glad you brought up the former president's legal team because he just hired two new attorneys over the weekend to lead his team. This was after all five members of his previous team left. So what happened and who are these new lawyers?
Yeah, someone close to the president told me that it was, quote unquote, a mutual decision. We don't know what that means on the inside. But there was some disagreement There was reporting that there was some disagreement on how much to focus on whether or not there was widespread election fraud too, because the president has still not conceded in this election, and he will not essentially do so. And that's been backed up now by the brief that's been sent in. Yes, it's mostly focused on the Constitution, but there is a line or two about the election. And, you know, they essentially said that, the president denies that there was any that it was done correctly. So, you know, that's basically where we're at, where we have a president and his legal team saying still that this is not was not a fair election, even though it was, even though there was no evidence of widespread voter fraud, even though this went through multiple courts, dozens of courts. That's what they're going to argue. Now, Republicans in the Senate would prefer that that is not the focus of the argument, because if it is the focus, sure, that could be problematic for Trump and his legal team. They'd much rather focus on the constitutional argument and be able to sidestep the substance.
Got it. That's NPR's senior political editor and correspondent, Domenico Montanaro. Thanks, Domenico.
You're welcome.
One of the most consequential journalists of our time is calling it a career. Washington Post executive editor Marty Baron may be best known to the public through the actor who played him in the Oscar-winning film Spotlight. Here's Liev Schreiber capturing the way Baron pushed the Boston Globe to investigate sexual misconduct in the Catholic Church.
A Boston priest abused 80 kids. We have a lawyer who says he can prove Law knew about it, and we've written all of two stories in the last 6 months. This strikes me as an essential story to a local paper.
The Globe went on to win a Pulitzer, one of 17 Baron has had a hand in. His accomplishments also include being my boss twice at the Globe and at the Post. And Marty Baron joins us now via Skype. Marty, welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you, Cal. Appreciate it.
So you're retiring at the end of this month, and I think most of the journalism world is sorry to see you go, with the possible exception of the Boston Globe's current editor, Marty, who may be happy that you won't be around to recruit his reporters down to the Washington Post anymore. But in all seriousness, why did you decide that now is the right time?
Well, I'm retirement age. I'm past retirement age. I've been the top editor at three news organizations now for 20 years. I've been in the business for 45. I've done that all without a break. I would like to have more personal time and personal liberty. And it seems like a good place to do that. There's a new administration. It seems like a natural turning point. The Post is in a really good place. So it seems like a really good time to move on.
In a note to the Post staff, you listed some of the biggest stories of your career. There was the Catholic Church investigation that I mentioned at the top. Before that, of course, there was Bush v. Gore in Florida when you were the top editor at the Miami Herald. At the Post, you revealed the NSA's sweeping surveillance program through documents leaked by Edward Snowden. Marty, I'd love to know if there's a less famous story that sticks in your memory. Maybe there's something from your early career that helped shape you?
You know, the Elian Gonzalez case in Florida was hugely important. Tremendous tensions within that community over the Cuban boy who had been picked up at sea. His mom tried to get him out of Cuba. She died at sea, and he had relatives in Miami. They wanted him to stay in the United States, but his father, who was still in Cuba, wanted him back, as you'll recall. And there was a huge custody dispute. And ultimately, the federal government went in and seized him and returned him to his father, who was then waiting in Washington. It is a hugely important story in Florida and raised a lot of important issues as well, and brought to the fore some significant ethnic tensions within Florida itself.
Did you take something from that story, Marty, that influenced the way you covered either immigration issues or policy matters or human interest stories going forward?
Yeah, I think so. You know, an area that we could have improved even at the Miami Herald was to even listen more closely to members of the Cuban-American community. You know, they felt as if this boy had somehow gotten over the equivalent of the wall in Berlin and had made it to freedom, and that it made no sense and it was unjust to return him to Cuba. And agree or disagree, it was our obligation as journalists to listen and listen closely to what they were saying and why they were saying that. We did that. I still think that we might have done better. And so that is a lesson I took from that experience.
So, Marty, the first time we worked together was on the 2012 campaign at the Boston Globe. And I will say that there were plenty of tense moments covering that election, but I almost always felt like the relationship between the presidential campaigns and the press was respectful. That wasn't the case in 2016 and 2020. So what's your assessment of where things stand now between politicians and the media?
Well, there's always going to be tension between politicians and the media. I think certainly during the Trump administration, it was at a very low point. I hope we don't go lower than that. Look, he described us as enemies of the people, as traitors, as garbage, scum. The administration, in many instances, treated us that way. And then its followers, whether they were politicians or ordinary citizens, started to treat the press that way. I hope we were beyond that. I think that there will always be tensions between the press and government officials, but it needs to be respectful. And I think we're going to get back to that. There will be tensions with the Biden administration. There's no question about that. There's an assumption with people who lean to the right ideologically that we had a warm, cozy relationship with the Obama administration at the Washington Post. We did not. We were consistently denied interviews with President Obama in the final 2 years of his presidency, despite continually asking for one. And they said no repeatedly because they didn't see us as a place where they would go unchallenged. And that's okay, because they should be challenged, regardless whether they're in the Democratic Party or the Republican Party, regardless of who they are.
You know, some of the criticisms launched at the press, including from the former president, are often launched on social media, of course. You yourself, Marty, are a famously infrequent tweeter. I think you tweeted exactly twice in all of 2020, and you haven't posted anything in almost a year. But many journalists, including the ones who work for you, are much more active on social media. And some of them have occasionally run afoul of you and other top editors at the Post for sharing their own perspectives on news events. And sometimes those are the historically marginalized perspectives of women and people of color. Have you been too rigid in enforcing journalistic notions of objectivity?
Well, first of all, I don't tweet anymore because I've grown to dislike Twitter as a forum for sophisticated discussions of the issues of the day. But we allow people to participate in social media, of course. That's fine. They can have a social media presence. But we try to take great care with what we publish. And we have layers of editors who review what we intend to publish to ensure that they meet the standards and principles and core values of the Post. We want to hear the voices of people who come from different life experiences, people of different identities, people who see the world differently. We want them to share those perspectives internally. We want to see it manifested in the journalism that we practice. But we need to make sure that when people are on social media, that they are meeting the standards that we try to enforce in our journalism and in other fora as well.
But what about this argument, Marty, that the sort of the notions of journalistic objectivity are kind of intertwined with a degree of white privilege, that it's easier for folks like you and me to kind of detach ourselves from some of the most socially contentious issues in our country, because oftentimes they don't directly affect us in the same way that they do women and people of color, and that maybe we need to rethink those standards in journalism?
Well, we need to understand what objectivity is and what the origin of that term was. The origin really dates back 100 years to Walter Lippmann when he wrote about it. And I think people have routinely mischaracterized what objectivity is. It's not neutrality. It's not both sidesism. It's not so-called balance. It is that a recognition, in fact, that all of us have preconceptions and that we need, when we go about our reporting, that we need to approach stories in an open-minded, fair, honest way, and do our reporting and do it really thoroughly and do our research in the most rigorous possible way. And when we've done that, the notion of objectivity is that we will then report what we find in a direct, forthright, unflinching way. The idea of objectivity was to counter the propaganda of the era during the Woodrow Wilson administration. So I think it's a good concept. And I don't think the alternatives are terribly good. And the alternative is that in a newsroom that every individual should be able to say whatever he or she wants, however he or she wants to, And I don't think that really works terribly well. And it has the effect of undermining the reputation of the institution. And I think it's important to point out that we are an institution. We are not just a collection of individuals. We as an institution stand for the practice of journalism in a certain way. In fact, our principles were set down in 1935. They are on the wall as you walk into our newsroom. They've served us well all these years, and I think they continue to serve us well.
Marty, you mentioned earlier some of the challenges that you could foresee covering the Biden administration. I'm curious for the journalism industry writ large, what challenges you see in, say, the coming decade, because we've seen the pandemic really accelerate some of the existing challenges, particularly for local news.
Right. Well, there's any number of challenges, and ours is a field that will continue to be challenged. Most immediately, there is the challenge of the financial challenge, particularly for local journalism. And it's important that we have strong local journalism if we intend to have strong communities and strong and to have democracy remain strong at the local and state level. Longer term, I think we face a huge challenge, the biggest challenge that I think journalism faces, and that is that we as a society can no longer agree on a common set of facts. You know, it was Senator Daniel Patrick Moynihan who famously said, you know, you're entitled to your own opinions, but you're not entitled to your own facts. Well, these days, people believe that they are entitled to their own facts. Those so-called facts may be disconnected from reality. They may not be supported by evidence, but people continue to hold on to them because they reinforce their pre-existing points of view. And so conspiracy thinking has become deeply entrenched in American society and, in fact, in other societies as well around the world. And that's a huge challenge for the press, but it's a huge challenge for democracy as well. How do we have a functioning democracy if we cannot agree on a common set of facts? And how do we have journalism if people will not accept our role as an arbiter of facts? I don't think that we are the only arbiter of fact, and we are an imperfect arbiter of fact as well. But I think we have to have, that is a huge challenge for journalism today and a huge challenge for democracy.
Marty Baron, executive editor of The Washington Post, thank you for speaking with us as you prepare to enter the next chapter of your career, and thank you also for your influence on my own career.
Thank you, Cal. I appreciate it.
Support for Here and Now and the following message come from MIT's System Design and Management, jointly offered by MIT's School of Engineering and the MIT Sloan School of Management. Earn a master's in engineering and management. STM educates mid-career professionals to solve complex challenges at the intersection of business and technology. With over 20 years of on-campus, hybrid, and distance education experience, join a virtual info session on Tuesday, February 9th from noon to 1 p.m. sdm.mit.edu.
If you're never quite sure how to answer the question,
where are you from?
NPR's Rough Translation might be the podcast for you.
Yes, finally, someone else.
Give us your accents and your origin stories, your cross-cultural misfits, yearning to just be, and listen to Rough Translation on NPR.
The pandemic is making Amazon very, very rich. Later today, for the first time ever, the online retail giant is expected to report more than $100 billion in quarterly revenue. Let's take a look with Robin Farzad, host of Public Radio's Full Disclosure. And Robin, Amazon made a lot of money in the fourth quarter, and a big chunk of it from the holiday shopping season when the company says it delivered 1.5 billion packages.
I mean, it's surreal to see a corporation of this size, of this heft, still grow its business at such a clip. Amazon is already worth $1.7 trillion. It's estimated, Wall Street says that all of e-commerce grew by about 50% last year. Within that, about 40% of U.S. online shopping happens at Amazon. So I used to compare Amazon to a massive planet or a gigantic sun, but it's more like this gargantuan black hole sucking everything into its abyss.
Wow. So what should we take away from that earnings report that's coming later today?
Well, that disruption can be quite disruptive and unfair, actually. I don't think Wall Street judges Amazon as a retailer, you know, scrutinizing same-store sales or profit per square foot. Is it a grocer? I mean, it owns Whole Foods. Is it a logistics giant? You think about all those trucks and planes and warehouses. No, is it a cloud computing colossus? You add it all up and the universe seems to just give Amazon CEO and founder Jeff Bezos the ultimate benefit of the doubt time and time again. And it drives competitors, which, let's face it, everyone is a competitor. It drives them mad.
Yeah, remember at the start of the pandemic, Amazon, I guess you could say, kind of struggled to keep up with the surge of online shoppers, and then rivals like Walmart and Etsy were kind of giving them a little bit of a run for their money. But apparently, Amazon figured it out over the last couple months.
Yeah, that's why I think this is kind of asymmetric competition and warfare with them. You know, the benefit of the doubt that I mentioned, it kind of extends to the culture of investment at Amazon. If management wants to have a quarter or two of deferring billions into expansion, well, you as the shareholder have to accept that. During the pandemic, we saw Amazon add more than 400,000 workers, and it also goosed warehouse and provisioning square footage by almost 50%. Again, for a company of this size, that just doesn't happen.
Wow. So not only was it Amazon that hit this $100 billion milestone, but Apple just did the same thing a few days ago. What does that tell you about the power and the clout of these big tech companies in the middle of an economic crisis?
Yeah, Apple, Facebook, Microsoft, Amazon, big tech really thrives. It has the balance sheets to adjust in a time of crisis. They have the network effects of massive user bases. I think, Peter, it's the exception to the rule when something like COVID happens and a third party player like Zoom pounces on a niche opportunity, a sudden need. But big tech already had its hands full with so much else. If you just take Amazon in isolation, not only did grocery delivery demand skyrocket, what about the streaming boom? You know, people binging, how that taxed Amazon Web Services. Think about Amazon Prime Video, in addition to its many other businesses.
So there's the tech giants. And then look what's happening over at ExxonMobil. The company reported its first annual loss in 40 years. What's happening there?
There's that famous business school line, innovate or die. Exxon was, as recently, I think, as 2013, the country's most valuable public company. Its full year 2019 profit was north of $14 billion. Then, with the pandemic and all the attendant economic woes, everything fell apart. Billions and billions in write-downs. It's selling furniture basically to maintain its dividend. It got kicked out of the Dow, and now it's kicking and screaming into a carbon-constrained future. And just by way of conclusion, Amazon is now worth about 8 Exxons.
Robin Farzad, thanks.
Two state lawmakers in New York want to ban police officers from using chemical agents on children, anyone under 18. Their effort follows an episode in which Rochester police handcuffed and pepper sprayed a 9-year-old girl, as seen on body cam footage released this week. The officers involved have been suspended, and now New York State Senator Samra Brouk wants to take legislative action. She represents the state's 55th Senate District and is chair of the chamber's Mental Health Committee. Senator Brouk, welcome.
Thank you for having me. It's good to be here.
I have to ask, what was your reaction when you saw that footage of a 9-year-old girl being pepper sprayed?
You know, my reaction was similar to, I think, a lot of our reactions, especially for folks here in Rochester, New York. You know, this isn't the first time we've seen something like this. And it was horrific. And it was traumatizing to see a small child treated with such violence and, you know, having a pepper spray in her face. And more than anything, I think it just added to the need and the urge that we all have to try to do something about it.
How about what you're hearing from your constituents?
My constituents, we actually have heard from a lot of them. They are reaching out and they're sick of it, frankly. They don't want to see their city and their community in national headlines for something like this. It's not a proud moment for them, nor for me. And, you know, they look to their leaders to say, well, what can we do? You know, we've been down this road. How is this still happening?
Well, to your point about having been down this road before, you know, the city of Rochester created a person in crisis team after the death of Daniel Prude. He was a mentally ill black man who died a week after being in police custody last March. This team is a group of mental health professionals who are supposed to be dispatched to mental health crises related to 911 calls, but they weren't dispatched in this case. So why not? And how did the system fail this young girl?
You know, I'm glad you brought up the person in crisis team. And, you know, it's very new still. It got up and running very, very quickly. I definitely think we need to continue putting resources into that group of mental health professionals to help folks who are in crisis. But because of a number of circumstances, they were not deployed in this instance. But really what this comes down to is that under no circumstances should a child be pepper sprayed. Under no circumstances should a child be violently pushed into a police car having not committed any crime. And so we really want to focus on, regardless of who is showing up, can we at least make sure that we aren't attacking our kids with something like a chemical irritant?
And so this is the thrust of a bill that you've proposed. You would like to bar police officers from using chemical agents like pepper spray and tear gas on children under the age of 18. Does that go far enough in your view, Senator, or is that just kind of a starting point?
I think it's certainly a step on the road to where we make larger reforms. You know, we always look at, you know, the bigger picture of where we want to move, but also, you know, how do I make sure this doesn't happen tomorrow? And of course, you know, let's remember, according to the reports, the police officers were acting by their protocol. So their policy is that you can pepper spray a 9-year-old. And that to me is bad policy.
Well, do you expect pushback then? Or do you think the bill will pass? I mean, is there some counter that you're going to get that says police do need the option of using chemical agents on minors?
I look forward to having those conversations. This was a very quick moving response. It's developing quickly here on the ground in Rochester. So I will continue to work with both my colleagues in the Senate, my colleague Assemblymember Meeks in the Assembly, and of course, our local folks here on the ground in Rochester to make sure that we move forward in a way that's going to be the most protective for kids in the future.
So that's the big picture policy debate that may shape what happens in future police interactions. But in this particular case, Senator, the officers involved have been suspended with pay as an investigation is underway. In this case, what would you like to see happen next?
I would like to see a full investigation, and I would like all of us to take that moment to reflect, you know, take policy out of it, take titles out of it. We're all human beings at the end of the day. We're all sons and daughters. Some of us are parents ourselves. And let's just think about the fact that a 9-year-old girl has been traumatized because the adults in her life sprayed chemical irritants in her face when she was having a crisis. And I think that if we all take a moment to, as humans, reflect on that, it's a very easy answer that this is never the answer for a 9-year-old girl to have to suffer.
Yeah. It's New York State Senator Samra Rukh. Senator, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much.
In Texas, some counties are just beginning to roll out their COVID-19 vaccination plans. That includes rural places like Bastrop County, east of Austin. Ashley Lopez from member station KUT reports.
Bastrop County is one of the smaller counties the state has designated a vaccine hub. That means county officials and others have to figure out how to hold mass vaccination events with few resources. So nonprofits like Bastrop County Cares are pitching in. The group's executive director, Debbie Brissett, says they're in the early stages of figuring out how to get vaccines administered on a wide scale.
We're creating this as we go with no real model.
Most vaccination hubs in the state are in big cities like Austin and San Antonio, places with way more resources. And Dr. Desmar Walks, Bastrop County's local health authority, says they've already got a lot on their plate.
The problem of addressing how to get vaccines into arms is something that came upon us in the middle of a huge public health crisis.
But Walk says she's up to the task of mapping out all the barriers they face in Bastrop. One of those has to do with how people will sign up to get a vaccine.
First of all, a lot of people out here don't have good internet connectivity.
That's Edie Clark, a leader with Bastrop Interfaith. She says before the pandemic was even an issue, groups in Bastrop had been working on improving access to the internet for thousands of families.
It limits access to healthcare in general, you know, just doing a telemedicine visit.
That means some folks are going to have to rely on getting things set up over the phone.
We have 95-year-old people calling us that don't use text very much. And when you call them back, they think it's a scam because they're getting scammed all the time.
Brissette with Bastrop County Care says it will take a lot of hours to work out details for appointments and scheduling follow-ups for the second dose.
Because many people need kind of not hand-holding, but it's all this is complicated, and we're building it from scratch.
And then there's convincing younger working people to make time to get vaccinated. Brissette says there are a lot of people in Bastrop, for example, who commute into Austin to work.
They work long, hard hours, maybe 2 and 3 different jobs. And so even finding time to get a vaccine and to wait in line means they are losing money. They're hourly workers often.
Hourly workers in Texas are often most at risk of getting COVID and are more likely not to have sick pay or health insurance. And Edie Clark with Bastrop Interfaith says some of these families have no idea what's going on.
What I'm hearing from some of the residents, you know, in Stony Point are that they're not really aware at all of how to get the vaccine or what they need to do or, you know, the website or the phone number. Any of that is at this point.
Stony Point is a largely Latino community. A few years ago, the Bastrop County Sheriff's Department turned roughly a dozen of its members over to Immigration and Customs Enforcement for deportation. Many of those arrested were pulled over for minor traffic violations, like a broken taillight. Clark says residents are still reeling.
They have a lot of distrust and fear of giving their information out without knowing it's not going to be used against them.
Access to vaccines is also an issue. Most state providers are clustered far away from the communities of color that have been disproportionately affected by the pandemic. Bastrop's health authority, Dr. Desmar Walk, says one of her biggest priorities is ensuring they have access to the vaccine.
And part of being designated a hub is that we commit to reaching into those communities, and that is going to happen.
Bastrop officials have started administering vaccines through their hub in small appointment-only events. They say these are test runs until larger shipments arrive. For Here and Now, I'm Ashley Lopez in Austin.
California's Yosemite National Park is open again after some wild weather forced it to close for almost 2 weeks. Last month, a windstorm knocked down 15 giant sequoias in Mariposa Grove. Sequoias are some of the oldest and largest living trees on Earth. Then, heavy snowfall caused even more damage. Yesterday, I spoke with Jamie Richards. She's a park ranger and public affairs officer at the park.
It has been a challenging couple weeks here in Yosemite National Park, but we are thrilled that the park has reopened after a series of storms. As you mentioned, we had the Mona wind event that knocked down a bunch of trees and caused some damage throughout the park. We were still assessing conditions from that storm system, and then we had a series of winter storms come in, and we have a lot of snow now, and we've been working hard to get parking areas and roads back, which we did this morning. So the park is open, and it's a great day to be in Yosemite.
Now, when you say a lot of snow, in Yosemite Park, that means something different than like a lot of snow in Boston, for instance. Like, how much snow are we talking about here?
It does. And the volume of snow that we had in this particular storm is a lot even for Yosemite. So over a couple days in Yosemite Valley, we had snow accumulation between 2 to 4+ feet. In other sections of the park, we had over 6 feet of snowfall.
Wow. What's that do to the park? You can't get around very easily, I'm sure. Is that why you closed?
It's a heavy, wet snow, which added some challenges falling on our trees. You had tree branches and some of our pine trees and oak trees that just fell over. So we had not only snow in the roadways, but we had to go out and get our road crews to remove a lot of tree branches that were creating hazards.
Well, it must be pretty, though. What's it look like outside your window?
So it is a partly cloudy afternoon. You have lots of snow piles. It's a great day to snowshoe and ski in Yosemite. We're going to have snow likely for several days into probably a few weeks. So it's going to be a great time to come and experience winter.
Oh, Jamie, let me just say, I wish I could come up and join you. More importantly, maybe than anything here, is this wind event that you were talking about earlier in the year in January. What happened that knocked down those sequoia trees?
So January 18th into the 19th, we had the Mona wind event in this region of Central California. We had winds that were strong enough to blow over giant sequoias. From our initial assessments, we found that 15 of the giant sequoias in the Mariposa Grove were knocked over by the force of those winds. That is a pretty significant event.
Wow, what a shame. You know, I saw pictures online. It was heartbreaking to see those trees on the ground.
You know, this is nature at work. So yeah. It certainly is something that is challenging. It certainly is something we've never seen in our lifetime. But at the same time, it is a natural process.
All right, well, next week, all park visitors are going to have to reserve day use passes. Is that to keep your visitor numbers low because of the damage we've been talking about and the snow that we've been talking about, or is that for some other reason, maybe because of the pandemic?
Yosemite National Park is working really closely to help manage and maintain safe conditions for visitors coming to Yosemite National Park in response to the COVID-19 pandemic. February is actually a very popular month to visit Yosemite National Park. Thousands of visitors do come to Yosemite to experience winter and also to experience a natural phenomenon known as the Horsetail Fall event.
Yes.
So for the middle 2 weeks of February, with the right light conditions, the right weather conditions, the sunset glows on the eastern side of El Capitan. There is a waterfall that comes down, and if there's enough snow and if the temperatures warm up enough that the snow melts, creating a waterfall that glows and looks like it's on fire at sunset.
Wow. And some years it doesn't happen at all if there's not enough water in that waterfall. So what do you think? What are the forecasts like for firefall this year?
So it's really hard to tell what's going to happen this year. We do have a lot of snow. The question will be, will the temperatures warm up enough that the snow will melt, generate in the waterfall? So it's really hard to tell right now.
Talking to you is sort of like talking about food when you're hungry. You know, like, we've all been locked up inside for so long, the thought of going to Yosemite and seeing this stuff is so appealing. What have your numbers been like over the past year? Have you just seen a bunch of people coming into the park because they just need to get out and go do something?
Yosemite National Park has been a very popular destination, particularly with people here in California within driving distance. Anecdotally, we've seen full parking spaces in some of our more popular trail corridors, like the Miss Trail Corridor and the Yosemite Falls Corridor, have been very busy. And one of the tools that we're using to help mitigate impacts is putting a day use reservation system in place for the month of February. We want to make sure that visitors that come to Yosemite National Park are able to have a safe and fun experience while they're here.
Jamie Richards, Park Ranger and Public Affairs Officer at Yosemite National Park. Bundle up. Make sure you've got those snow boots strapped on tight. Thank you very much for talking with us today.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure.
And Jamie sent some of the photos of the fallen sequoias and the mountains of snow in the park. We've got them at hereandnow.org. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Peter O'Dowd.
And I'm Callum Borchers. This is Here and Now.